Blog Talk Radio.
Hard Talk with Miss E. Today is Wednesday, May 11th. It's the second Wednesday in the month of May. And it's also the week following a very highly celebrated holiday this year, or during this month, I should say, which is Mother's Day. And for those of you who have tuned in to our program in the past, you may have heard several of our guests speak of the impact of the women in their lives or not in their lives, whether it was biological parents, whether it was foster parents, adoptive parents, or just members in the village. And our topic tonight is maternal relationships. Who needs a mother? And I pose this question because there is the concept, especially amongst permanent placement and adoption for older kids, and when I'm speaking of teenagers, people stop looking because they say, you know, well, why would you even bother to adopt a teenager? Well, my question is, when do we ever outgrow the need for a maternal figure in our lives? And not just sometimes a figure, but someone that we can really count on. I want to read something to you that I picked up from the blog of a young lady that I follow on, I'm not sure if it's WordPress, but it's on the internet. And she goes by the name of LT. And this is one of the things she stated, and I got her permission to quote her on several things. But this has really touched my heart. This was on Mother's Day. She said, it's the biggest day of the year for long-distance telephone calls and one of the biggest days for purchases of flowers. Today is Mother's Day. It's a hard day for those without mothers or with poor relationships, and I send my thoughts to everyone who is motherless today. But I also send my thoughts to the good mothers today. It's the most important job in the world. And she went on to explain a situation where she's temporarily staying with a family. She's a young adult who's aged out of the foster care system. And she described a setting with the mother of one of her close friends, and that on Mother's Day morning, she did not want to be in the way. She did not want to intrude upon that mother's Mother Day celebration because the bottom line, she didn't feel a sense of belonging. And she went on to describe the conversation that she had with the mother of her friend and sharing a card that she had given her for Mother's Day. And I won't read the whole thing, but she told the mom, she said, thank you for letting me stay here and helping me. I don't have anyone else, you know. Well, thanks. She said, I felt tears starting to well up in my eyes. I was trying hard to stop them. Here in front of me was a mom, not my mom, but one that I've wanted so bad. One that seemed perfect to me, one that didn't call me names, hurt me, abuse me, trick me, give me to men, hit me, burn me, tell me I was worthless and a mistake, et cetera, one that was a true mom. And then they fell, dripped right to the floor, and before I could wipe them away, the mom gently hugged me, and I let her. I didn't flinch. I didn't jump. I didn't move away. I stood there crying. Then she touched the back of my head and said, I'm glad we could help. I know it's not been easy for you. You're always welcome here. I just cried. I never had a friend, and I don't have a mom. And at that moment, I felt like I had both. I still get emotional when I read that, because in our society, we're moving so fast. And when we do take a moment to acknowledge people in our lives, we just assume and we take for granted all the things that we have. And granted, everybody has a different story. But in my heart and in my mind, for someone who has gone through life without this, and LT isn't the only one, it's so important to acknowledge where people might be at this time when we're, you know, as I would say, doing the hullabaloo over, you know, the things that we just do because, and it has no significance to really look at the meaning behind it. So today I have actually invited four former foster youth and a surrogate mom to our program. And at the time, we have two of the guests on the phone. And I will ask them to share a little bit of their story. And one of the things that I've asked them before to share about is, what was your earliest memory of not having your biological mom in your life? What is the first memory you have of anyone being your mom? And how did that impact your life even today as an adult? The other question is, what is it that are those maternal figures did that impacted your life both in a positive way and or in a negative way? And lastly, what would you say to the village moms out here, and what would you say to those who are still perhaps looking for a mom? So at this time, I will introduce to you Ms. Lucy Hamby and Ms. Carrie Fox Kelly. Are you on the phones, ladies?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Ms. Carrie?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. Welcome. Welcome. The other guests that we were expecting were Mr. Rob Garris from New York, Ms. Jasmine, also known as Jazz Hudson, from California, and they also wanted to talk about their maternal relationships in their lives. And Mr. Rob Garris from New York, actually, we're going to have him to come back at another time. He is a professional fighter and has a big fight coming up, and he wants to speak out on behalf of the foster youth we say the United States, but as Ms. Shea Liberia says, it's not just our block, it's bigger than your block, so I would say throughout the world. So, Lucy and Carrie, why don't you start off by sharing with us, what is your story about being without your biological mom, and what is the first age that you recall not having your biological mom? Let's start with you, Lucy.
Okay. I was 2.5 and I was placed in foster care. So I knew at a very young age that I didn't have a mother.
I'm going to ask you to start over again because there was some interference at the beginning, and I want to make sure our listeners are able to hear. So there was some distraction. So could you start again, please?
Yes. I was 2.5 when I was placed in foster care, so I did not know what it's like to call anybody better. In all my life, I didn't. And some of the foster then, they wanted me to, but they would ask me to, but I just couldn't. So I always knew, and I just always felt like I grew up without a mother.
Okay. So at the age of 3, you were placed in foster care?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so how did you proceed? Do you have any memories prior to being in foster care?
My mother was schizophrenic, and she had a and nervous breakdown, they called it back then. It was in the 60s. And she screamed all the time, and she said scary things. So I was a little girl, but my memory of her is just that she was scary.
Okay. So, and then you went into foster care. Ironically, May is also National Mental Health Awareness Month, and I really have wanted to do a program for those youth who had spent time living with a parent who had a mental illness. So we may not get that in during this month, but perhaps at a later date, because that has a strong impact on young people as well. So when you were placed in foster care at the age of 3, how long were you with that family, and did that relationship develop in terms of your feeling a sense of mothering there?
I was in foster care the first time for over 2 years, and my mother was in a mental institution at that time, and they were like grandparents. They were actually like grandparents. They were very kind, and but they were like grandparents, not really parents. They were older, and even when I went home, you know, it was not the same. It was always scary to know that someday she would be that way again. So.
So you actually went back home, and how long were you with your biological mother at that time?
Until I was 11.
Okay, so most of your formative years, or those pre-adolescent years, were with her, so that must have been an extremely chaotic time for you.
There was no supervision. There was no supervision. Most of the time, school would start in September, and we would know school would start when the bus would go by, and we'd go the next day. I mean, there was no supervision. Or she did take us to church.
Okay. What was your perception of your life with your mother as opposed to what you saw with perhaps other children, and what was the desire of your heart at that time?
What was the desire of my heart was to have a real family. Always it was real family, but it just seemed like it just wasn't possible. It just wasn't possible.
Okay. So in your little mind, what was a real family?
It's not like some of my friends at school, they would be clean, and their mothers and fathers would come to school and help with parties and things like that, and I didn't have that, so.
And
I'd go spend night with friends, and they would have sit-down dinners. And my mother stayed in bed basically my whole life. That's pretty much all she did. She stayed in bed.
Okay. So basically you were having to take care of yourself at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I did.
Okay. And, you know, and it's interesting. I'm going to go up to Carrie for a minute, then we'll come back. But I look at parenting, you know, as there are usually two types of parents, if they're even present, and I say that the nurturers are providers, and when you're doing good, you manage to get both, and one is to make sure that you have the basics, and the other are the nurturers who can really be attuned to your emotional needs, and I think when you grow up without one or the other, there's a real challenge that you face in life. So, but let's move on, and I just want you to be thinking about that while we speak a little bit to Carrie and bring her up to perhaps to about that age, and then we'll continue to talk about the impact that had. Carrie.
Okay, well, for me, what I remember was I did live in a foster home. And the earliest memory that I have was when I was 3 years old living in the foster home. And then when I was 4, I remember the day I got adopted to a new family. And I really liked my foster home, and I'm 4 years old, and I didn't want to leave my foster home. What I remember is, when I was being taken away from the foster home to live with my new
mommy and daddy. I was in the car in the back seat, 4 years old, crying my eyes out. And my new mommy turned around and pointed her finger at me and told me to shut up all that noise. So that was the introduction to my new mommy and daddy.
What had things been like in the foster home?
What I remember the most in the foster home was Christmas. I remember going to see Santa Claus. I remember being told to go to bed and be a good girl so that Santa would come tonight, and then waking up, and I remember, like, all these presents that I got. I remember, like, a lot of Christmas presents. And then my birthday is the week after Christmas, and I remember arguing with my foster mom about, you know how people teach their children how old they are, so they teach you that you're 3 years old. And so I've been saying that I was three years old this whole time, and then all of a sudden here's my birthday, and she's going, so today's your birthday, so you're four. And, like, I remember, like, stopping my little foot, putting my hands on my little hips going, I am only three. I'm 3 years old. And she just laughed, and she kept thinking, you know, she kept saying, well, today is your birthday, so now you're four, you know. So it was, that's mm-hmm. the earliest memories that I have of the foster home. And I just remember being really happy there. And, mm-hmm. I mean, my nightmare started when I got adopted. It was not a nice family to live with. It was just really, really ugly, and the new parents and the new family was just very abusive, and so
like Lucy, you had, even at a very young age, you had a contrast. You had something to compare your negative experience with to know that there was something different and something better.
Yes.
Would you say that as well, Lucy?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm sort of pausing there because when we go through what happens, you know, in a child's early development, people assume that as a young child, that children don't know any better, or, you know, that, and they don't bother to try to explain anything to them. They just bounce them around, not like it really stops when they become older. But I think they don't pay close enough attention to what that child is taking in. So you both knew the difference between when you felt valued, when you felt loved, when someone thought things that you did were funny as opposed to being reprimanded for having your emotions. So this, you know, for both of you, I guess it was about 3 years of age that you first experienced a contrast. So, and what were, if you can label the thing, let me go and read this, something else that I got from LT's blog space. He talked about what the characteristics are of the people or the women in her life that she wished were her mom. She said, you listen to me even when I'm deaf to what I'm saying. You help me to see things when I am blinded in self-hate. You understand me when I am confused. You help me to reframe thoughts even when I present a framed picture. You validate my feelings even when I deny them. You meet me where I am instead of assuming I should be elsewhere. You respect me even when I don't respect myself, or worse, when I try to get you to disrespect me. You are gentle even when I am self-violent. You are firm even when I try to persuade you. You are calm even when I am exploding like a bomb. I wish you were my mom. Wow. Does that, any of those words ring or touch any emotions for either of you? I'm sure it must trigger some type of experience where you either had or did not have that, especially as you approach and went through adolescence.
Well, okay, for me, hi, for me, this that really describes my godmother, who I grew up in church, and so there was one woman who really exemplified pretty much everything that you just read off, and I asked her to be my godmother at a very young age, but I only got to see her during church, and then during the holidays, there was a time where I could spend the night at her house, and me and some other girls who had also asked her to be our godmother. What's interesting is that she never actually had biological children of her own, but she treats all of us as if we were her biological children.
Mm-hmm. So you saw something that you liked and you recognized and you asked for it.
Yeah.
How old were you when you asked her to be your godmother?
Oh, probably 8 or 9. Okay. I'm not really sure exactly when, but I know it was before I was 10 years old because my adoptive mother had a stroke when I was 10 years old, and I know that I already had my godmother before that. So.
Okay. So it sounds like that was about 10 for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you recall at that age, did you recall being nervous about asking her, or did you just blurt it out, or had you thought about
nervous.
It?
No, I just blurted it out, and I wasn't nervous because she took a lot of time with us. We were probably, she probably was driving me and some other people from church or a choir rehearsal or some kind of event going on at church. I just remember being in the car with her by myself, either on my way home or on my way somewhere with her, and I just asked while we were in the car. And so, it wasn't a nervous thing. It was just something I knew I wanted, and I just did it like that.
It just happened spontaneously.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Lucy, did any of the things that I read trigger any memories or thoughts for you about either of the mother figures or parents in your life?
They were all just very authoritative, and they had all these rules that you had to live by. And back when I was growing up, it seems like they were all, it was like their religious duty to do it. And so they were just doing it to give a kid a home. They really were. I never felt at home anywhere, and I was always continuously put down. And I don't know exactly how I survived, but I did, and with a great attitude. I feel I have a great attitude. And I think I went to church also, and I connected with elderly ladies, like Sunday school teachers, and they would take me home with them. So the world was my mother, I guess. Sunday school teachers, but I never asked anybody to be my mother. I never said, I want you to be my mother. I never picked anybody until I was 16, and I went to live with my God-given mother that I still have now for over 30 years, and she never discouraged me or put me down for anything I did, or she would ground me, and she'd just tell me, you're not a bad kid, you're just a teenager. And I would do the teenager things. I would skip school or stay out after curfew, but it took her about a year. And I told her, I said, I cannot call you mother, and she is fine with that, but she is my mother, and she has been since I was 16. So it took me that long to really, really mm-hmm. want a mother, ask anybody to be my mother.
Wow. So at 16, was she a foster parent?
She was. She was. Okay. I had gotten in a lot of trouble in another county, and they sent me to this little backwoods town, and she was just the most awesome person. And no matter what I did, I didn't think I would be there long. I really didn't. I thought that, that if I still behaved like I always did, she would send me away, and she didn't. And she He still keeps me now. So.
I love it. I love it. And that's when what we talk about, unconditional love. And even though you did not get her until you were 16, but the most important thing is that you found her. She found you. And I believe in talking about this, I have two goals. For one, to validate the needs and the emotions and feelings of those who have not had a biological mother present for them and have gone through life not really feeling like they belong or that they were accepted by anyone. The other thing is to teach how to be able to get that and to recognize that we never outgrow that need. And I believe that for those who feel like, you know, I've never had anyone, I never will, that is not true. And even though I had my biological mother, I still had needs. And fortunately, I had a godmother who was just the lady who lived downstairs from us who became my godmother throughout life. And when she died, when I was 40 years old, I was still looking for a mom. And my current godmother, I just called her one day and I said, you know what? I'm not even going to ask. I'm just telling you, I want you to be my godmother. And today she's 87 years old, and she just, you know, and my own biological mother is now deceased. But she just fills a place in my heart that I know is, you know, the part of that little girl inside of me still needs her. And so this is a call to the village, is to not assume because someone is of a certain age that they don't need that nurturing maternal relationship. And part of, you know, the way of finding that is to be able to identify what it is that you want. So as we went through LT's list, some of those things you both mentioned that you had in your godmothers. And I guess the other side of the question for me, as a foster parent, as an adoptive parent, and some people call me the universal mom, auntie, I guess my question I would say to you, because Lucy, you indicated that you didn't call her mom, you didn't expect her to be around. What was that like when the lady just never gave up on you?
It was like taking a deep breath and just like, after so many years of being shifted around and living the way I had, it was like taking a deep breath and feeling at home finally. Finally feeling at home.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that kept you from really saying that you would not call her mom? What was associated with that for you?
I really don't know. I really don't have an answer to that. I just don't. When I talk about her, I will say my mom, but to actually call her, I think it's because all the other kids did, and, you know, and it was like, other kids could just call everybody mother, and she's my mama Myra. So I mean, there's two names to it, but other than that fact, I just did not understand how somebody could just call everybody mother. It just was not something
right.
I could do.
It's like using the word love. Some people could say I love you, but it's not. You know, you want to know that this is real. I'm not going to give you this role in my life haphazardly.
Right.
And I think a lot of caregivers expect kids to immediately just click with them and drop all of the hurt and pain that they've had in the past and to trust them, and it doesn't come that easily. It doesn't come that easily. And I was hoping that we would have someone to represent the surrogate mom and the lady that I had scheduled, but she had something come up today and is unable to be. Her name is Elaine Barnes-Bateman, and she has a program called Ruth Project, and she also has been titled the ambassador of another organization called Mother of the World, and I love that title because I just believe that that's what some of us are called to do. And I wanted to hear from her what it was like to be able to mother someone who had been hurt and wounded and perhaps might reject. Because some of my experience has also been a lot of hurt, but I still speak that our young people still need us. And the title of my book is It's Hard Work, Being the Village That Raises a Child. And the heart you know, it's about heart. You know, your heart sometimes will get wounded and hurt, but we can't stop loving. And actually someone asked me the other day, they said, you know, I was thinking, you know, you love purple and you have a heart. So does the purple heart stand for a bruised heart? And I said, unfortunately, sometimes yes, but we have to keep nurturing and healing our hearts so we can continue to give back. And it's a difficult place to be in, but I still, without a shadow of a doubt, know that it is worth it. So now your situation was different because you didn't get a permanent home and you kept going through the whole foster care process until you were 16. And a lot of times as advocates, we argue that children need permanence. But unfortunately, Carrie had permanence and it wasn't a positive situation for her. So Carrie, as you went through trying to get a sense of connectedness in life, and you ended up at 9 years of age getting your godmother, I'm wondering, was there any hesitation on your part to acknowledge her as your godmother for concern that your adoptive mom would have issues with that?
Well, she did. Okay. For the most part, everything was so distant, and it was all from, you know, I didn't have her on a day-to-day, you know, minute-to-minute basis, like, you know, like if somebody was, like, next door around the corner or down the street. So I only got to see her during church and on special occasions like holidays, Christmas holidays. So my mother wasn't threatened until one day there was a special service, church service for this particular woman who was my godmother. And one of the people who had lost his mother at a very, very young age said something like, you know, he had wished that she was the mother, his mother, or she, you know, took the place of a mother that he had never had. And that gave me an idea to, like, get back at my mother who was so cruel and so mean to me. Knowing that I was adopted, I said something to that same effect, like, you know, she's like the mother that I never had, you know. And that's when ugliness got even, you know, it got really bad where she started trying to keep me away from my godmother. Like when it came to the holiday season where I always went to visit her, my mother said, no, you can't go. So, that's when, but I never worried about, you know, there was no, there wasn't any competition with this particular woman in terms of, you know, hostility or anything like that. She was just hostile anyway, and it didn't matter, you know, who it was. Everybody could get love from her except for me, and I was adopted. So, you know, that was just, it was never, you know, it wasn't an issue until I actually made it an issue.
And so basically, so you spoke up.
I did. In my, like 10 or 11-year-old way, I spoke up and caused, you know, all this friction. And then, but it, eventually it went back to where I could still visit and I could call and I could, you know. And then, but then my adoptive mother passed away when I was 13, and then I moved in with another family on her side of the family, but I was still, quote unquote, the adopted one. Even though their mother was really good to me, she worked a lot and she wasn't always there, so I was stuck with 5 kids that were mean to me, and then my adoptive father was busy doing his own thing. He didn't really want much to do with me. So here I was in a whole nother house that I was trying to acclimate to that didn't work out too well either.
Wow. Oh, that's one thing after the other. One of our other guests, Miss Jasmine Jazz Hudson, has joined us, so I'm going to bring her in and hope that her background is clear of background noise. Jazz, are you there?
I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello?
We got you. Hi, we're glad you could join us. I'm sorry
Thank
you. We're holding so long because we were just talking. I turned away from the switchboard, so I'm glad that you're there. But you were able to listen in to the first part of the call, right? Or at least
I'm not sure who's telling what story, so I'm a little lost on the conversation.
Well, I have Lucy and Carrie on the line, and Carrie's from here in California. Lucy is from Alabama, and I introduced your name before to say that you would be representing Northern California. And what we were talking about, each of these young ladies had experiences of not being with their biological parents at a very young age, but having experiences where there was a contrast in the type of mothering that they received. So one of my first questions that I asked them is, what was your earliest memory of not being with your biological mom? And then how did that impact your life at that point? So that's for you.
I'm sorry. I think my connection is bad because I'm on a cellular phone. I heard how did that affect your life? I didn't hear the beginning of the question. I'm sorry.
Okay. At what age did you, what age were you separated from your biological parent? When were you aware of that, and how did that impact your life at that time?
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, I'm at work, so I took my lunch break for an hour to be a part of this, an hour and a half to be a part of this conversation. So the service here isn't all that good.
We're glad you're here.
I was disconnected from my mother at 3 months of age, and I didn't find out that she wasn't, the mother who raised me wasn't my real mother until I was about 11 and a half, almost 12 years old. So I was raised by my father's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And when I found out that she wasn't my mother, because of how young I was, I guess my father felt that the information was too much for me to comprehend at the time or too much to swallow. But even the fashion in which I found out that my mother who raised me was not my biological mother, it still didn't give me a good advantage to, like, really go through what I was feeling. My father, he, one day randomly, we were going for a ride, and we had just left from my mother's job. My mother worked for the city of Oakland at the time, and this is my mother who raised me. And we were leaving, and I asked him, I said, Daddy, where are we going? He's like, oh, we're going to see your mom. I was like, well, we just came from mommy's job. And he was like, well, we're going to see your mom and your brothers and sisters. So I started naming off my brothers and sisters that I knew to my knowledge, and he said no. And so I kind of just ignored it because my father is someone who jokes a lot. And we pulled up to this house, this, like, old Victorian house, and I got out of the car, and about five kids ran up to me and just started hugging me out of nowhere. And I kind of freaked out because I didn't know these kids. I was predominantly raised like an only child. All my siblings that I was raised with are, like, 10 years older than me. So when I got the children to stop hugging me, my father grabbed my hand, and we walked up to the stairs, and we opened the door, and there was this woman staring there, and my father said, this is Miss Kimberly. And I said, well, hi, Miss Kimberly. Nice to meet you. And she gave him, like, a really mean look, and he was like, this is your mother. And she, like, grabbed me and hugged me and wouldn't let me go, and I started crying. And then, like, a older lady came and started hugging me and wouldn't let me go, and later to find out that was my grandmother. And on the spot, like, my dad said, well, you know, Cheryl's not your real mother. This is your mother. And I just asked, like, at 11 years old, I just, like, can I go outside and play? So now knowing that, like, psychologically, even when he told me and I was presented with her, I initially, like, just still blocked it out and was like, can I go outside and play? And went to play with these kids later to find out that were my siblings. My father left me there that day, asked me if I wanted to play with the kids, stay and play with the kids for some more. And I said, yeah, he left me with her for a week. It never came back.
My God.
So that was the most traumatizing thing in my life, because my father and my mother who raised me, I was pretty much raised in a two-parent home, middle class, private schools, and then he left me in West Oakland with people smoking and cursing. My siblings at the time, they were, like, really jealous of me. I got into a fight with my sister who was, like, 18 months apart from me. I had another sister that's 3 years younger than me. She kept biting me. I flung her into a wall, and I got in trouble by my biological mother, and she said to me, I said, you can't touch me. You're not my mom. And she took me in the bathroom and whipped me with a shoe and said, if you don't remember anything, you'll remember this about me, that you got a whooping from your mother. My father came and got me, and I told him everything that happened. I had witnessed people smoking weed. I had witnessed violence. Like, a whole bunch of things I'd never been around my whole life. I mean, maybe at birth, because come to find out, like, afterwards, my dad, like, told me the story that my mother was addicted to crack, and she lost custody of all six of her children. I am her third child. And my father at the time was a big-time drug dealer, and he pretty much turned his life around when he found out that I was being born. And he fought as his own attorney and got custody of me. And my mother, who raised me, was already with him. And because she was so in love with him and he cheated on her from my mother, he was like, I'm going to raise her. And she took me in. I don't feel like I started to feel the effects of not having my biological mother until I became, like, around 13. Because my grandmother that I met at the time, I got to build a big relationship with her, and she died a year after me getting to know her. The only person who was, like, blood connected to me, only woman that was blood connected to me. And she died a year later, and my mother, who raised me, and my father, they split up, and I went into the foster care system after that.
So you didn't go into the foster care system until you were almost a teenager.
Yeah, I was there as an infant. My father fought to get me out, and I went back in as a teenager.
Wow. Now, what was your relationship like with Cheryl? It sounds like that was a positive relationship.
It was a really positive relationship, but never really deep along the lines of learning womanhood lessons. My mother, Cheryl, who raised me, she is a businesswoman, and she pretty much, like, always taught me things like the financial aspects of things and, like, how to sustain a living. But when it came to, like, puberty and my period and my body changing, my father taught me all about those things. And I remember when I turned 12 and I said, Daddy, I got a mosquito bite on my chest. And I ran downstairs. And him and my mom in the kitchen just cracking up laughing. And then the next day I was like, Daddy, I got a mosquito bite on the other side of my chest. I'm, like, crying. I'm freaking out. And they're laughing, and so my dad came into the room with all these pamphlets about your body is changing and period. And I cried, and I was like, I don't want to talk to you about this. You know, I want to talk to mommy about it. He's like, no, you're going to talk to me about it. And I just didn't understand why. And I was like, I just don't want to talk to you about this. And the things that were going through my mind is that my mom's not my real mom, and why is my dad talking to me about this? And growing up, whenever the first boy broke my heart, I could never really talk to her about it. We never really connected on that level. And knowing her mother, who was my grandmother, she was like that too. She was really, really not emotionally connected. And my father was that mother for me. And and now we have a really tight relationship. It's still not that, like, deep and emotional, but she's learned a lot from me. And I learned how to start to break down those things and just get there, like, a love for women and appreciation for women through creating, like, mothers in my own life. Once I went into the foster care system, I went through several group homes. I've been to over 20 group homes and about 10 different foster homes and in about 27 different schools. So in total, 30 different places of living, 38 different places of living in 27 schools. And I ran away a lot. And for the majority of my time in the system, I stayed on my own as a ward of the court, a runaway. as a runaway, staying with my boyfriend, staying with random people that I met on the streets, because I couldn't take the group homes and the foster homes and the treatments that I got there. I always felt isolated. I always felt like an outsider. And there was probably a few group home staffs that I could connect with and that were kind to me, but just the environment was nothing like I was raised with, you know, growing up, like, pretty much middle class. And now class really doesn't have that much of a standing anymore, but at the time it did, you know, in growing up in a house, growing up in a pretty much suburban area, now going to living in the hood and being in group homes and fighting for everything and not having anything. And so it was just huge.
So
for
it wasn't moving that maternal relationship, or it was losing the family as a whole. It was losing your culture. It was losing your privilege. It was losing everything, basically.
It was losing everything.
You had to go into survival mode, and not only for physical survival, but for emotional survival. I want to tune into the other callers, because what we just sort of covered the issues of the pre-adolescent age, and we were talking about choosing people in your life to be that maternal figure in your life. And so you were saying, having gone through all of these people, did you have contact with either Cheryl or Kimberly during the time you were a ward of the court?
I didn't talk to Kimberly again until I was 18 years old.
Okay.
And then I had contact with Cheryl pretty often. Like, she worked for the city of Oakland, so even when I was out on the street, I would just go to her job. She would always give me money. My father at the time, he had disowned me. He was really heartbroken and disappointed in me. And so he would have nothing to do with me. But my mom, she would take me and buy me clothes. And I remember one time I went down there for some money, and she said we were going to go get something to eat, and she set me up. The police were there waiting for me, and it took me into custody. But I always talked to her, and I used to tell her, like, you know, I want to come home. I want to go live with you. She wouldn't take me back into her care because I was out of control. And she was like, no, you have to show me that you want to come home. And so there was this ongoing battle between her and the system, because she would tell me, yes, I want you to come home, but my social worker would be like, nobody wants you. Your foster mother or your mother who raised you doesn't want you. And so I was just going through so many things. And when you look at it, I left home when I was 12 years old. And so from 12 to I went back to live with Cheryl right before my 17th birthday. So pretty much 12 to 17, I was in and out on the streets. And my boyfriend and whatever I thought was older or something like a mother or a father, a parent figure, raised me. And to me, I was like, I raised myself. And
so
now,
for you, it was slightly different than the other ladies' experiences. And this is why I try to have more than one perspective, because I want everyone to be able to understand that every person's situation may be different, but what's in the heart generally remains the same. Because it sounds
right.
Like, one, there was a contrast that you both knew that you deserved or wanted more, and you knew that it was available. So you, all three of you, had something to compare it to. The other part of that is how to get that for yourself. And even though you may not have made the best choices at certain points, you continue to move forward and seeking that out. So the question that I have of you, and then I'll go back to the other ladies, but I asked them, when they sought out or were connected with the people, the women in their lives, who gave them that maternal nurturing that they needed, were they aware of it? So after all, you were out there being, you know, on the run and AWOL. Who were the people that you latched onto? Were there any women that you latched onto? Or even now as a young adult, because I know that you're very active in your community and you have a wealth of maternal figures around you. How did you go about selecting the people to keep in your life?
It changed for me when I was, so from 12 to 15, I had a boyfriend who was like 4 years older than me, and I lived with his family. And at the time, his aunt was something like a mother figure to me. But she did what she could. You know, I would talk to her about things, and she let me stay there. She, you know, she was more just like, she was just a woman present around, but as I got older, I recognized that she wasn't even really like a mom or auntie. I called her auntie all the time, and I recognized that she wasn't really an auntie, and she was still really trying to find herself. She had two children and took in my boyfriend at the time and his sister, and she dropped out of school in the ninth grade. And at the time when I was like 12 to 15, she was maybe in her late 20s, early 30s. And so she had no education, really. And we were living in public housing. And then the guy I was with, he was really abusive. And so I was finally able to get away from him. And a friend of the family, she took me in. And I stayed with her. And pretty much under the terms that I could stay with her is if I would clean and I would watch the kids. So I would clean and I would watch the kids, and I got to stay with her. But she was a little bit beyond that. She was graduated from high school, had a job working at the post office. She was really positive, but she had men issues. Like, there were men always in and out of the house. So her example that she set for me was really just not loving herself, and the only way you found love was through men. So I never really got nothing from her. And because of the way I was raised, when I was in care with my father and my mother who raised me, I knew that all these examples were wrong. And so I always felt out of place in group homes. No matter where I went, I always felt out of place. And so my mom said, if you want to come home, you need to show me. So I turned myself in, and I went to a foster home, and that didn't work for me. And I ran away, and I went back to staying with the last lady. And I pretty much talked to my social worker and said, I'm not turning myself in, but I will get enrolled in school, and I'm staying out under these, and I'm going to go back into care when you put me in care with my mom. So I met a guy by the name of Ice Life, and he began to mentor me, and I got into poetry, into my community. And when I got into poetry and into my community, I came across this organization called Leadership Excellence, and I met a woman by the name of Derica Blackman, who was the executive director at the time for Leadership Excellence. And I went through a week-long camp called Camp Akili, and they went through sexism, gender racism, and it was the first place where I ever could open up about being raped and ever be in a circle of more than 20 women who share the same story. And like you're saying, like, we share the same story. We may not have gotten there. Our roles may be different, but the stories and experiences are still the same. And so I kind of latched on to her, and she took me under her wing. I went back into custody with my mother, Cheryl, who raised me, and she's my son's godmom now. And I call her for everything. And so I could count on her to be that emotional support and to kind of give me, like, the wisdom and the keys to life and growing up in womanhood that my mom, Cheryl, can't give me. And I recognize there's things that she can't give me because she never got them. And that the things that I get from my mother, Derica, is things that I pass on to my mother, Cheryl.
Okay.
And I eventually met my biological mom at 18, and that didn't go so well. It didn't go so well. Okay. And I've seen her
and
again recently.
That's going to be another program. We're going to talk about that in another program.
Right.
Lucy and Carrie, did Jess say anything that struck a chord within you?
The part about, like, never fitting in, never feeling like you belonged, or, you know, just the only difference for me is that I never left where I knew I didn't belong. I mean, I did try to leave, but I always got, I always chickened out and went back, and, you know, because I thought that leaving was going to be worse, like whatever I was going to go into was going to be worse than what I was dealing with already, because that's the way everybody, you know, talked to me. They were, I mean, my dad at 14 years old, after my mother died, actually drove me to, at the time it was called Whiskey Gulch in East Palo Alto before they did all this work, and that's where, like, all the, you know, drug addicts and prostitutes, and he basically said that was going to be my life because I would never amount to anything, and this is my dad driving me over there. So, you know, I understand where she's coming from with the never feeling like you belong wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Knowing that there's something different. But in your case, you wasn't sure if there was anything better for you.
Right, for me. I knew everybody else could have better. I knew everybody else's life could be better. But for me, I just thought because I was, okay, I'm visually impaired, and I've always been visually impaired, so I was going to struggle regardless. And so because of that, I just thought if I find anybody that's going to take care of me even a little bit, I better stay put.
Mm, wow. So that was a statement about your self-worth and your value.
Right.
What about you, Lucy?
Yes, like them, I also felt out of place anywhere I went. And, but I don't know. I think I was born with hope and a great big heart. And I just always knew that someday, some way, there would be a mother for me. And I did find her when I was 16.
Right. And I think one of the things here, you know, the intent of you know, the program is to, one, again, to give a sense of awareness to the community, and the other is to help create an environment for those who have not come to the place to see, receive, or have what they need in their lives to be able to know how to go about getting it, and for the village to know how to go about giving it. And so I'm hearing that each of you, one, needed to know, one, that there was something different, and somehow you already knew that. But the second part of that is knowing that you deserve, and that there was value in you that deserves, and that someone could and would give you that.
This is Jazz. I think the other piece that is really important to me is how to get to it, because the woman before said, you know, I'm sorry, I'm really bad with names, so I'm hearing the names, but I'm more so hearing the stories. She said, you know, I never left because I felt I would leave and I would always come back. And for me, from 12 to 15, I stayed with the boyfriend, Lee, in an abusive situation because I felt like that was better than anything else. And here I'm coming up with, like, broken jaws. I don't have clothes. I'm being verbally and mentally abused. And I know that I'm not supposed to be there. But I couldn't move because it was something, I felt like anything else was worse. So it took a long time in, like, creating a community and a mom for myself and a family for myself came way later at, like, 17. And I'm only 22. Mm-hmm. So none of these experiences were that long ago.
Exactly. So what would you say to women in the community, and this is for all three of you, and I know that each of you have even more to tell of your story, but I really want to get to how can the women in the community be better mother figures or nurturers, as I would say, and what would you say to those who still find themselves without that person in their lives? And we can start with either one of you.
Some you might find in church or teachers. Sometimes teachers are really good. And I don't know. It's just so hard to search and to find.
To the people in the village, to the women in the village, what would you tell them, first of all, if they desire to share with a young person, whether it's a daughter or a son, you know, male or female? Unfortunately, we don't have our male representative on the line tonight. But what would you say to someone as they're looking in the community and how they can be a nurturing figure to a young person?
To not force it. Just slowly,
okay.
Patiently show them love, because most of the time they've never known it before. It may take, it's not going to happen in a day or week. It may take a year, but you really have to have patience and love them, because they're not going to be ready to accept your love. That's what I would say.
They're not going to be what?
Ready to accept love.
Okay, exactly. So be prepared for maybe not to be just readily received initially, But be patient and continue to give it. Be consistent. Okay. Anyone else?
Jazz, I would say to women in the community looking to reach out to young women or children in the foster care system, and particularly young women, is to be honest. Like, even for our maternal mothers, a lot of adults don't share their experiences. I'm sure there's some experiences that Shaw went through before I ran away from home and before I went back into the foster care system when dealing with men or dealing with identity that she couldn't help me with because of the disconnect that she had between her mother. And I'm sure even now, out of the several times that I've tried to reach out to my real mother, there are some things about her life and herself that can save me and give me clarity to who I am now and the things that I don't recognize about myself that come from her. And just, and I think a lot of times, just as people, we are sometimes fearful of sharing our stories and sharing our experiences. And because I am an African-American woman, I know heavily in the Black community that this has always been taboo to talk about the things that we go through or happen to us that are hardships. And a sign of endurement and strength is to just keep it going. But how do you help the people underneath you if you don't let them know where you failed? So I think that's really, really big. And the other piece for young women looking to create a mother or a family or that maternal sense for themselves is to, one, start with being open, finding a peer or somebody that you can trust. Some of my mothers came from my big sisters that I found in group homes. And then some of the other people came from teachers. The biggest thing now is I surround myself by older people that are either somewhere in life that I know I want to be. So find someone positive that has something or someplace where you want to be. And simply just open yourself up just a little bit to learn from them. And that doesn't mean you have to, you know, tell them everything that you've ever been through or everything about them, but open yourself up a little bit just to be able to receive the wisdom and knowledge that they might have to bring to you.
Beautiful. So, and I think that's so true as exemplifying your story that, you know, you were going to people who really weren't in a better place. And I think that one of the clear things is to look and find someone, and or not even necessarily looking for them, observe the people that you're around and identify those that are exemplifying or demonstrating the type of life that you would like to live, not what you don't want. And if you don't find those people as you're going around, as I always, you know, go with Shay Oliveria, she says that life is bigger than your block. It means being exposed to other things and other situations in which you can see people. And I think that is so important to get out and to do things. And I know you've done lots of things, you know, beyond your own immediate living environment.
This is Carrie. Can I just interject one little thing about when we're talking about women that want to reach out to, you know, foster youth and adoption, you know, and thinking about adoption? One of the things that I found out just recently, and I'm talking about days, the mother that adopted me thought that I was going to fill a void in her life, and that's why she adopted me. So where I'm going with it is, if you are trying to find a child or have foster youth or adopt a child because you think that child is going to fill a void in your life, very carefully look at that and make sure that you're not just bringing someone else in on top of all the mess that you're not dealing with, thinking that child is going to fix you and your problems in your life, because it turned out that I didn't fix anything. She just brought me into, you know, the chaos and the more mess in her life, and then she became jealous and abusive. So, you know, it's nice to, like, want to help and reach out and everything, but, very, you know, if you can really, you know, look and see if, if it's a good idea, and if you're able and you have the means to do that mentally, physically, emotionally, on all levels, then by all means, please bring, do what you can to help. But if you're just doing it because you think this child is going to fill some void or whatever is missing, and, you know, you're not really dealing with whatever your situation really is, then don't do that to a child. Don't do that.
That's a really amazing piece, because I was just going to say that about young people, like, in retrospect, like, looking, when young people are looking for a maternal person or someone that they can, like, be like a mother piece to them, to ask yourself, like, healthy questions, because even for me, some of the women that I latched on to, I was latching on to them to fill a void, and it caused me to have unhealthy relationships with friends that were young women and older women, because I thought that they would help me with my abandonment issues. And so I really had to go deeper within myself to ask myself healthy questions and to really start to pay attention to the things that I would do that were not healthy or not normal. So when I did create this family or create a mother or something for myself, that the relationship was as healthy as it could be. And so that's really – that I'm really glad that you said that, just for the older people looking to get a foster child or adopt a child.
Mm-hmm. Now, the question that I have, because we all have some voids in our life, and, you know, we talk about there's the quote that says, you know, find a need and fill it, and not only in, you know, someone else's, in ours. But don't you think there's a sense of balance with that? What would you consider to be a healthy reaching out to fulfill a void or need, and what would be an unhealthy?
I think it has to be an individual, you know, it's kind of like the man in the glass, or in this case, the woman in the glass. When you are truthful with yourself and you understand what you're really looking for and what's really needed, and you're being truthful and honest with yourself, you're not going to go wrong. You know, I believe in divine intervention and divine synchronicity. The person that you are, you know, the thing that is missing in your life will show up when you know what that is. But it's not going to show up if you're delusional about everything.
Yeah, delusional.
I love it.
Yeah. That's what I cannot understand. All the kids, you know, they would just latch on to it. They would come and go, and every one of them would call everybody mother, and so that's one thing I could not understand. And I was picky, so I waited to find the perfect one. So, but yeah, that most of the time they're doing it with a delusion that they're going to get this perfect child, and they're not. It's going to be work, but it's worth it. They just have to work with.
Exactly. And I think the other part with that, when you're clear, you know, to me, it's like selecting mates. That if you're going for something and you're totally, you know, have your expectations, you can have desires, but there won't be resentment when you recognize if you're really putting your all into it. And I just look at, and I spoke earlier about my own pains in mothering, you know, my foster and adoptive sons. And I think people will ask, well, if you could do it over again, would you do it? And I said, I sure would. They would say, even with the same outcome, it's like, yes, because I know that the bottom line, it made a difference in their lives as well as mine. It might have not been the outcome that I expected, however, but I do believe in that divine intervention, that everything happens for a reason. But at the same time, there's always that question mark in the back of your mind. So I really hope that when we have this conversation again, that we will have some other caregivers on the call as well, because I think that bridging that communication gap between the loving and the caring, and avoiding that sense of resentment that comes up, and it's all about everyone understanding the intent, and that is so, so important. The other question, we're taking the call a little longer tonight, but I think we're going to probably go for about 10 more minutes. For those of you who are mothers, did you have any reservations or, I guess, as someone said about delusional thinking, about being a mother that either affected your decision to have or to not have children?
For me, it made me definitely know that I would not have children. And I made a decision when I was very, very young that I would never have children, for mostly for the fact that I'm visually impaired and for the things that happened to me right under the nose of 20/20 vision. I thought I would never be able to keep a child safe because I couldn't see everything that could happen. And then I thought I'd be paranoid because I was just so convinced that somebody was going to do something to my child. So I thought I would probably, like, have a nervous breakdown worrying about my child. So I never had children.
Wow. So, and then also not wanting to put that on the child.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I'm just a little bit different. I have a son. My son will be 4 on May 23rd. And so in having him, I wasn't really fearful that I couldn't take care of him. I just really was fearful of if I was ready. And so now raising him that he's here, I'm always really overly conscious about the things that I do. And the thing that freaked me out the most is like, dang, everything I do right now influences him and how he'll grow up. And I remember I was just crying one day and I was like, what if because of what I don't know about my mom or the things about me that I still don't know about myself or how my dad wasn't and was with me, what if that comes out and raising a star? And I was just tripping. I was like, I could never deal with me messing up my kid. And one thing I was really scared about and prayed for was that when I had a kid, when I was pregnant, before I knew the sex of my child, is that he wouldn't be a girl. I was like, please don't let me have a girl. Please don't let me have a girl. And even now, I mean, I've said it before, like I truly do fear having a girl because I didn't start having friendships with women until I turned 18. And the friends that I have are still the 4 friends that I found when I was 18.
Wow.
Or 17. They're still the 4 friends. And every other woman I know is just an associate, but never that close. And I hung out with men. I have mostly brothers. I hung out with boys and nephews and my brothers. And that's just who I felt comfortable with. Never felt too comfortable about women. And even now I teach young women, and we work through in the workshops that we're teaching them is about why do women have these issues with each other, these trusts with each other. And I stand by this firmly that I don't want to have a daughter until I get some type of for real healing with my mother because I do not want it to play out. I couldn't deal with it. And I know I took my parents to hell.
I got goosebumps when you said that because that is always, even though I'm past childbearing age now, that was always a concern for me because, you know, because of the relationship I had with my mother, I was concerned, even though I was, you know, conscious and aware, but concerned about those deep-rooted emotional issues that might come up with a daughter. And that is very interesting that you would say that, and I wish most people would be very much alert and aware of that. And I think because it has to do with, because I was a daddy's girl, had a very close relationship with my father, even though I lost him at the age of 14. But I'm thinking for people who've gone through, you know, just all kinds of things, who didn't even have, not even a bad relationship with their parent, you know, just didn't have one, how that affects. So we have to be aware, but it's all about self-awareness. And again, self-worth and knowing that you don't have to become the person that you don't want to be. And it takes a lot of heart work and a lot of transparency, a lot of being able to connect and trust someone else to have that. So I commend you.
See, Ms. Hart, my thing is, what about becoming the person you don't know? See, my fear is not becoming the person I don't want to be. Like, I see the stuff about my father and my mother who raised me and could say, okay, I see how they got there. I don't want to be that. I'm not going to be that. But there's so much about my biological mother that I don't know. My fear is becoming what I don't know.
Okay. Can I just address that? Because I'm adopted and I have no clue about my birth mother at all.
And mm-hmm. I'm the one who decides who I get to be. I get to be the one that make the choices on how I deal with situations that come my way. And so, you know, you if you listen to your intuition and the little voice inside that tells you what's right and what's wrong, I don't think that you will become someone you don't want to be, because if you're paying attention to your intuition, you won't it won't steer you wrong. That's what I think.
Mm. Thank you, sis. Thank you.
And I believe that, you know, you both acknowledge that you believe in there being, you know, a divine or spiritual influence in your life. And I think when you have that awareness and you do the work that you've already begun and you're connected to your source. See, other people have been guided and influenced by the external influences in their life. And I think that's part of your insurance package. Lucy, I know that you're a mom. What were your thoughts about being a mother before you had your children, and how has that played out for you?
I didn't have any concerns. I just knew that I would have enough love. But I did have five other siblings, and so I decided that I only wanted one child. I made that decision, and I only had the one daughter, and I spoiled her rotten, and we had the family dinners, and I let her do things like cheerleading and baseball and all the things that I didn't do, and I was a little uncomfortable doing it with her because I had no clue. I wasn't used to it, but yeah, she's just a full rotten kid now. She's all grown, and she's a kindergarten teacher, and she's an awesome person.
Wonderful. Now, were you able to allow your inner child to come out with her, even though you had some apprehension because it was all new to you? Was that a time for you to be able to do some healing with your inner child by letting her play?
Miss A, I've done daycare all my life. I have never grown up. I have been a child always. I have always worked, so I am an inner child forever.
Okay. I am an inner child. My inner child is me. I like that. And actually, we're going to do a special program on that, about releasing our inner child. Wow. Awesome.
I believed in education, so I wanted her to learn and read. I read to her, and I knew how important reading and understanding. And so I'm just I'm my own inner child. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So for each of you, what is Mother's Day, and what was this past Mother's Day like for you?
Mine is for 30 years, I have spent it with my God-given mother, and my daughter was out of town this year, so I didn't get to see her on Mother's Day, but she'll be back on Friday, so we're doing Mother's Day a week late. My God-given mother and my birth mother were friends. She was mentally ill, and she loved my God-given mother. And I just want to say this, that when my birth mother died, my God-given mother called the funeral home to come and pick her body up. So that it has just been an awesome relationship for all these years. And she made me understand my birth mother and know that she could not help the way she was. So
beautiful.
It's Mother's Day every day for me with her.
I'm just curious, and we can talk about this another time, but did she develop a friendship with your biological mother after she became your foster parent, or was she already a friend of hers?
No, it was way after. It was like, and I was already grown up, and my birth mother had breast cancer, and she was in the hospital, and my God-given mother worked there, so they got to be friends because she would take care of her at the hospital, so it was after.
Okay, and that's a special relationship in and of itself that I really want to talk about, because I've seen a lot of times where that has been possible, but that's another one. Carrie and Jazz, your experience for Mother's Day.
Well, what I do, and I just started this last Mother's Day, is I got a long list of all the moms that I know. I call all of them, text message, email, whatever way I can get in touch with them. I say Happy Mother's Day, and then my husband and I went to his brother's house to spend Mother's Day with his mom, because his mom is still alive here. And so
We spent the day there. So it was really nice. It was really nice.
Okay. Mother's Day for me, I pretty much lounged for a big portion of the day, and then I took my mother, Cheryl, and my sister, we took her to eat. And that was pretty fun. And then I took her to get an outfit. And then I went to visit my son because he goes with his father every weekend. My son lightened up my day because he didn't know it was Mother's Day. And he was like, oh, Mother's Day. He's like, well, can I cover my eyes and say surprise? I said, yeah, go ahead. He covered his eyes out. Surprise, happy Mother's Day, Mommy. And ran around the house telling everybody, happy Mother's Day. He said, it's my favorite day.
Oh, how sweet. How sweet.
And it was my best Mother's Day yet. I was really happy. I got over 20 text messages from people. It's pretty good.
Wow. Yeah. And it's interesting to now be in the role of a mother in addition to having that. And sometimes that's a double whammy for some of us. So I'm glad that you have shared so much of your experiences and your wisdom and your knowledge with others. And I think one of the things that you've also indicated at the end of this interview is that it's important to create your own tradition, your own way of dealing with it, and not buy into all of the hype that's on the television, on the radio, in the advertisement, because comparing yourself to those in that picture can also be disheartening. But to create, and when you say lounge, yes, to enjoy yourself, reach out to those who have in your life and to find those. So in closing, I would like for, if you have any projects that you have in place or something that you would like for people to contact you on or to follow you on, you can share that, because I know that not only are you doing your own healing, but you're also working to help others. So do you have anything that you would like to share with the audience on how to contact you and any projects they might follow you up on?
I have a show coming up where I'm singing with a new band on June 11th. It's going to be on the Berkeley campus. It's called the Peace and Unity Dance, or PUD. And you can find information at gpproductions.net, or you can friend me at Carrie Fox Kelly on Facebook. That's June 11th, starting at 3:00.
And that's for those who are out of the area. That's at UC Berkeley campus.
Yes.
And in Berkeley, California. Okay. Uh-huh. Thank you. And good luck with that. I'm looking forward to hearing you at some point.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I'm going to make that one. Okay. Lucy or Jazz?
If Jazz, I'll go. So I have a couple things. I have a show coming up on May 21st, open California at San Antonio Park, the Malcolm X Jazz Festival. I will be doing a spoken word performance there entitled How Are the Children? And then I also have another performance coming up at La Pena in Berkeley, La Pena Cultural Center, on May 25th. And I will be performing there, a fundraiser for young women who are artists. And I have a young women's support group for young mothers on May 28th. And the details for that are to be announced. But if you want to get in contact with me, you can follow me on Twitter, Jazz Poet, or you can look me up on Facebook, Jazz Monique Hudson, JazzMoniqueHudson. And to find out more about me and the programs that I'm doing, you can visit my website, www.miles.com/WordPress. And I also have my blog on there where I talk about issues growing up and issues, current issues with women in the community.
Wonderful.
And, yeah, that's me.
Fortunately, Ms. Jazz is so busy, we were going to have her at our Foster Pride celebration on May 21st. So we have a conflict of schedule, but there's room for everybody to do everything. And she's also an author, and we look forward to having her to share
coming back. Lucy, anything you'd like to share for people to connect with you?
No, I don't have anything going on right now. I just work really hard to keep awareness for the foster children alive, and not just foster children, but our children, because they deserve better in this world, and they are all treated. So.
Right. And would you like for people to know how to find you on Facebook?
It's just Lucy Hamby on Facebook. I'm just there. And I don't play the silly games. I just put messages out all the time when I find things going on about kids and adoption, and I believe in all of it. It's a broken system it's working. It's a little broken, but it's working.
And it requires each of our parts, and we all come with different gifts, different talents, different perceptions and awareness to make a difference. We have 4 minutes remaining. Jazz, would you happen to have a poem that's less than 4 minutes that you could share a lyric with us real quickly? I know I'm putting you on the spot, but you know how to roll.
Anything in particular that you're looking for?
Just something along the lines of what our discussion has been about. Young women looking for mothers, being a mother, or being yourself, growing into yourself, mothering yourself.
Okay, really quick. You know, silence is so loud, especially when you're a young 12-year-old girl covered by a darkened cloud. I never once opened my mouth to speak, but through my eyes my soul would peek. Walking a lonely path down Oakland Street to a mouthful of six bottom gold teeth. I was only 13, but having sex and selling D was nothing new to me. And as quiet as I kept, my life was a constant game of Russian roulette. And the madness when I let up, that is, to my face, his fist would always take bids. And at the age of 14, I already had one miscarriage, an abortion, and possibly two kids. See, picking up Atari or Barbie was out of the question, because growing up without standing up, I was destined. And even though my boyfriend should have been arrested, I was consensually molested. Sagittary rape written across my face was adolescent, and I didn't have to butt my head to learn that lesson, because he had already given that blessing. See, throughout these trials and tribulations, I searched for myself, trying to find me behind anything that resembled me. Throughout life, you will create your identity. You create who you are. Blessed and curses flow from my mouth like rivers. Our words create streams of life or death. So by any means necessary, by all means necessary, keep striving for a better living, making blueprints on the impressional imprints of life. Never will you be turned from your God-given right, nor be snatched away from your eternal light. You see, we are unrealized reflections of divinity. And although you may not see it, I will not let my mother be in a crackhead I never knew, nor how I went through group homes and foster homes and barely made it through as an excuse. Because like I said before, can't nobody hold you down but you. We are the future of this crazy world we live in. Peace. I shortened that.
Wow. Beautiful. That good purple. Thank you so much. That couldn't be more appropriate. Our call is going to come to an end, and I want to thank you ladies so much for being here. For those of you who are listening, please leave us a message on our Facebook page at Four Child's Heart. Four Child's Heart, Inc. And let us know what your thoughts are and any input and suggestions for our upcoming programs, and also if you'd like to be a guest. So thank you, everyone. Have a blessed week, and in 2 weeks, join us again. With Heart Talk with Miss E. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Heavenly Mother, crying. These children are dying. At the hands of the other child, I know her heart is breaking. Feel the earth is shaking. That rivers flow from the tears she cried. She cried. She cried. She ran to.